Welcome everyone to the Mycotoxin and Chronic Illness Summit. I'm Dr. Christine Schaffner, and today my guest is Joel Salatin. Joel Salatin and his family own Polyface Farms in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley, a multi-generational pastured livestock outfit that services several thousand families, numerous restaurants and food venues, and offers nationwide shipping for salad bar, beef, pig, pork, and pastured poultry, eggs, turkeys, and broilers. Author of 15 books, he is the editor of The Stockman Grass Farmer, the world's premier pastured livestock trade publication, speaks and consults on farming and food issues, and hosts countless infotainment gatherings on the farm. I hope you enjoy my conversation today with Joel Salatin. Welcome everyone to the Mycotoxin and Chronic Illness Summit. I have the dear pleasure of introducing Joel Salatin, and we're going to be talking about healing the land one bite at a time. Welcome, Joel. It's really an honor to get to interview you today.
Thank you, Dr. Schaffner. It's a privilege and an honor to be with you.
Oh, well, I, you know, just so enjoyed my time last year getting to visit your farm and be part of an amazing event. And you inspired me on so many levels. And I came home and, you know, I live in an urban environment in Seattle, and my husband and my daughter, we, you know, made a garden in our little side yard, and we grew some kale and some basil and some lettuce. And, you know, but it just was that, you know, really, insightful and empowering, like we all can participate, right? And no matter if you're in rural America or in, yes, you know, in the city, there's all sorts of ways for us to reconnect, right? Reconnect to the land, reconnect to the soil. And I've just been so inspired by your movement, right? Really this regenerative agriculture movement. And coming back to my office, I felt like I can't, you know, we talk about food and nutrition, but this takes it on a whole nother level. And so I guess where to start is, you know, what makes Polyface Farms different than, you know, the conventional outfit out there?
Yeah, so I think the foundation here is that we look at nature as template, at nature as teacher. So, you know, when you look at nature, A, you don't see 10, 10, 10 chemical fertilizer. You don't see Roundup. You don't see factory farming houses, you know, industrial. You don't even see tillage equipment. And so when you boil it all down and you really look at nature as pattern, as template, it's really elegantly simple. You know, we humans want to complicate everything, and it's actually fairly elegantly simple. For one thing, you know, every ecosystem has animals in it, and these animals move. You know, animals move. That's such a simple phrase, but we live in a time when, you know, most animals now in industrial agriculture actually don't move. You know, they're locked up in they move a foot, but they're not actually, as I say, they can't gambol on the pasture. You know, they're locked in. And so when animals move, if the animals are going to move, then we have to have some sort of control to protect and guard them and keep them where they need to be. We need some sort of a shelter and some sort of a portable feed source. So everything about them becomes mobile rather than stationary. So rather than stationary barns, we have mobile shelters instead of centralized, like, you know, water troughs. We have a water system that has access points all over the fields, and you can plug in a water trough here, there, over there, you know. So the mobility is a critical thing. And then another thing that you notice when you look at nature is that it's primarily perennials and not annuals. Now, to the folks that I don't want to, you know, talk over or leave anybody, an annual is like squash, watermelons, wheat, barley. It's something that has to be planted every year from seed. A perennial is a plant that flourishes year after year after year from the same root base. And so grasses, clovers, a lot of herb, field herbs like plantain, dandelion, you know, things like that are perennials. And so nature, because it, well, nature is primarily focused on perennials, not annuals. And the energy flow is completely different in perennials and annuals tend to extract soil energy and put it in a big fruit, a big nut, a big, seed. And perennials tend to put all their energy in the soil so that if a drought, a blizzard, a hurricane comes, the plant can regrow from its crown and not from a seed store or a fruit store. So we're into perennials rather than annuals, which means the primary. Now, does that mean I don't like squash? No, we absolutely plant squash and tomatoes and the annuals, but the foundation of the system is grasses, is this prairie, this multi species prairie. And then I've got just two more here quickly. One is that nature, what builds soil is carbon. Nature runs on a carbon economy. Chemical fertilizer does not build soil. So soil is built in nature with obviously solar energy through photosynthesis, making biomass, which can either then decompose on site or decompose through the gut or gizzard of an animal and come out as a concentrate known as manure and urine. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so both of those are decomposition, whether it's pine needles and leaves and grass that fall over and gradually decompose, or whether it goes through digestive process. In either case, it's biomass that decomposes. That's how soil is built. And so we have a big chipper that we can chip, crooked trees, diseased trees, basically weed the woodlot and take that C-grade, woody material and convert it to chips that can be then composted. And that drives the fertility program in the fields. So we have a fundamentally integrated system between forest and open land versus a segregated system where the forest never sees the open and the open never sees the forest. That, by the way, creates both a fungal and bacterial microbial community in the soil. Grasses tend to go toward bacterial, forests tend to go toward fungal, but the most fertile soils have both fungus and bacteria. And so the integration of the two creates a more fertile soil, a more biodiverse soil. And then the fourth thing on the template is that food sheds or the ecosystem tends to be a relatively regional ecosystem without a lot going out real far and a lot going in. Now, we've always had global trade, especially in salt and spices and specialty items like that, but we've never had shipped watermelons a long distance or squash, the watery things. Those have all been very, very close. And then if you're going to take a trip, you can take, for example, dehydrated beef or pemmican or some sort of high protein. That's what you can afford to send out of the cheese. You don't ship milk, you ship cheese. So natural food systems and ecosystems thrive on regional stability with their own diversity, preservation, and seasonal fluctuations, within that kind of regional ecosystem / food shed. And so we began actually selling to neighbors. We didn't say, oh wow, we need to export to Thailand or Bangladesh. Said first, let's take care of our neighbors so that we complete this cycle within the regional shed. And so those are kind of four ideas that we looked at and started developing these pasture-based, mobile, carbon-centric, people-centric, localized type of system.
I love this. And thank you for going through this. And as, you know, we had this conversation, you know, I really want people to hear, and we'll dive into, you know, why regenerative agriculture is so much healthier for themselves and the planet. And then I love this mirroring of nature, because that's what very much we do in our work as clinicians who are on the summit. And we see that a big part of why people are sick today is that there is really this disruption and the ecosystem of their body. All of these microbiomes that we've been learning about over the years, you know, not only our gut, our skin, our lungs, our brain even has a microbiome. You know, we're definitely in a low diversity, like overgrowth of opportunistic, you know, pathogens. Like it's a mess, you know, and that's what's creating disease. And so, you know, it's very much mirrored, you know, in nature of what's happening to, you know, in a conventional farm, right? Low diversity, right? Sterile environments. Can you speak to that?
And a kind of a simplified biome as opposed to a complexified, that's not a word, but you know what I'm saying, a complexified biome. And, you know, in the work with the microbiome, most of the sicknesses or the disease that we're starting to tag to microbiome deficiencies are tagged to something that's missing, you know, a sphere of enzymes, a sphere of bacteria, you know, a family tree, if you will, of microbes that are missing. Okay. And that becomes the issue. And so, you know, it's fascinating to me that, well, for example, the Aborigines of Australia are said to have commonly, you know, in a year consumed almost 2,500 different kinds of food.
Wow.
You know, Native Americans here consume something like almost 1,000 different kinds of food. And in fact, if you get Dolly Madison, you know, James Madison's wife, mm-hmm. Dolly Madison, she made a cookbook. She was a real, you know, gregarious hostess. And then Martha Washington, George Washington's wife, if you go to Mount Vernon and get their cookbooks, you look in those cookbooks today, and 80% of the ingredients, we don't even know what they are, you know, quinces and currants and all this, you know, what in the world is that? And so you begin realizing that we have industrialized our food system, we have dropped off this diversity to where the average American now really only eats about, you know, 15 or 20 different things. And we don't eat that, you know, 500, 600, 700 type of diversity. And so our bodies are simply not getting the kind of microbial diversity that comes in on a highly diversified diet. On that note, let me just say that at our farm, since we have concentrated on perennials in the pasture, and we move the cows every day to a new spot, so you have this mosaic. And what it does, it recreates the diversified prairie of yesteryear. I mean, most archaeologists now say that the Native American prairie, an acre, would have more than 100 species of plants in it. Imagine that. 100. So one of the things that I enjoy doing with visitors is go out in the field and just take a you know, 3 feet by 3 feet and say, what can I find? And typically, you know, I can find 20. And if I go a little bit farther, up to 30 or 40, even 50 different species of plants, you know, in an acre. It's not as diversified as the native prairie, but we're getting there. We're getting there. We're getting more every year. The latent seed bank is there. And what I want to just point out is that when our animals are on that diversified pasture, they're eating some plantain, some yarrow, some chicory, some you know, clover, white clover, alsite clover, and so the animals are getting this incredibly, incredibly diversified diet, not just corn and soybeans. They're getting this incredibly diversified diet, which then carries that microbial diversity into our microbiome, so that we can vicariously get more diversity. I'm convinced of this. I'm convinced that to the average person, telling them you need to diversify your diet by about, 80 different types of plants, that's intimidating. Whoa, I don't even know that. Okay. But one of the quickest ways that you can diversify your intake is getting pasture-based meat and poultry and eggs, where a very diversified sword of vegetation has come into that animal, and that animal's been able to metabolize all that diversity, and that then carries through onto your plate. And that is one of the quickest ways to significantly diversify your diet. So you get a little bit of dandelion, you get a little bit of lamb's quarters and chicory and sow thistle and milkweed and fescue and orchard grass and timothy and clover. I could just go on and on, but you get a little bit of that. And to me, that's a very, it's a very hopeful notion that if we move to a diversified pasture-based, even animal, that we benefit from all that dietary diversity that comes from the pasture.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And so well said. And as you're, what we call this is regenerative agriculture, right? So we kind of ruin our health, ruin the planet, but it's amazing. Mother Nature, right, can regenerate. And I think that is really the message that that gives me hope, right? I have a 3.5-year-old, so I'm always looking for that, optimistic, hopeful message of how to change the trajectory. And, I think that this regenerative and pasture piece, especially to restore our microbiome. And the point I think I want to bring in, Joel, is that many people who are listening are like, it's a pretty cool group. People are probably pretty educated. They're eating organic, they're thinking they're doing all the right things, but there's a difference, right? And so how can people make sure that they're making the choices that are going to be more aligned with your farm versus like a greenwashed organic choice that doesn't have all this benefit?
Yeah, well, bummers of the whole organic certification system is that it's kind of been co-opted now by the industry. And so you can now get organic, hydroponics, aeroponics, soilless fruit, soilless vegetables, and you're basically getting water and not nutrition. And so the organic certification and most of the eggs, organic certified eggs, are in factory farms. Chicken, all organic chicken, is organic big factory farms. And so how do you know? Well, one way, I'm a big believer in cultivating the skill of web sleuthing. Okay. Now, look, I'm a caveman. Okay. I don't even have a smartphone. Okay. But when people ask me this question, well, they often ask me, well, what do you think about this brand? I say, well, let's look them up on the web. and you look them up on the web. And if you look for Meet Our Farmers, and the farmers are, for example, standing in front of factory houses, that'll tell you something. For example, there's one large distributor that touts themselves as being, natural, and they're the homesteader food system, blah, blah, blah. You go to their homepage, look for, for their providers, and the background picture of the homepage is 5 Tyson chicken houses. So all I'm suggesting is, you have to be, discerning, and some simple web sleuthing. Do they allow visitors? That's a big one. You don't have to go visit, but do they allow visitors? On our farm, we have a 24/7, 365 open door policy. Anyone can come from anywhere in the world at any time to see anything anywhere unannounced. Now, I'm not saying it has to be that good. I would say that's a gold standard. If you want a gold standard, that's certainly one for transparency. But I've heard people say, if you go to a farmer's market and you buy from a farmer 3 weeks in a row, and he hasn't invited you to come visit his farm, there's probably something wrong with that outfit. Mm-hmm. And so, so, you know, transparency is a big deal. You know, how open are they for visitation, for, you know, actual eyes, you know, eyes on the ground. And then another one is just endorsements from people like you, people like me, you know, Sally Fallon, you know, Weston A. Price Foundation, you know, Tom Cowan. I mean, when these, Joe Mercola, whatever, you know, but when these kind of gurus of our movement, Zach Bush, okay, when these guys and gals, when they, you know, they're in the system, they're hearing the scuttlebutt, right? I mean, you know, they're in this. And so, you know, look at what the gurus in the integrity, authentic food system are saying. You know, what do they buy? You know, who do they get from? And, those are, you know, those are valuable things. And so I'll just say this. One of the neat things now that's happened in the last 10 years is the efficiency in logistics of distribution. So that our farm's a perfect example. We were cultishly local for many, many years. And then suddenly we started losing market to, you know, to door-to-door delivery outfits. And people didn't want to drive out here to get stuff and things. And so, so we finally, you know, 2.5 years ago, we launched a shipping program, a delivery, and, you know, it's not our biggest thing, but it's steadily growing, and it gives somebody in New York in a Manhattan apartment, you can get food that we pack right here at the farm, sent directly to you, no middleman, except for UPS, directly to you. And so the opportunity for both acquiring integrity food and the ability of rural farmers far away from metropolitan centers to access has fundamentally changed in the last 10 years as distribution logistics has become more and more streamlined, so that we don't have the cost, you know, the cost prejudice that we did, you know, even 10 years ago, mm-hmm. between that option and the bricks and mortar option. So it's helped both of us. There are a lot of things that are dysfunctional in the world, but the efficiency of logistics has really, really created new opportunities, both for the farmer and the buyer, the urban buyer, to be able to hook up with people that they couldn't have, or would have been more difficult to hook up with in the past.
Yeah, no, the silver lining, right, of the technology. Yeah.
That's right. It's a silver lining.
Yeah, bringing your food to, you know, again, more communities that are not down the street, you know, I think that's definitely, you know, like thinking about all the other things that we're shipping around the world, like, you know, regenerative foods, or, you know, please ship them, you know, so we need them, right? So, you know, and I know this is a point that you talk about, and, you know, people who are listening, you know, there's always the conversation, right, of, okay, is this food more expensive? Can I afford this? Should I have to only buy these things organic or regenerative? Do I have to, you know, succumb to the, you know, the foods that are, you know, more affordable? And, you know, I'd really love your education about access from an affordability standpoint of this type of farming and this food.
Yeah. So, of course, price has always been an issue for us. And because, you know, we're not making a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico the size of Rhode Island and asking society to pay for it, you know, right. So we don't have we're not making MRSA and C. diff from, you know, from subtherapeutic superbugs from feeding subtherapeutic antibiotics. There's a lot of cost in the system that the supermarket does not capture, you know, in the conventional thing. But to go straight to the point, realize that the satiation of authentic food is much more concentrated than in bad food. The Bionutrient Food Association just did a test with a spectrophotometer. It's, you know, this you know, what Abby has on NCIS, you know, she can put a spot of paint in it.
You know, what's in there. Yeah, right.
Mass spec, you know.
Yeah.
They just did this with carrots, for example, and they found that the difference nutritionally, they measured, I think, 150 measurable, whatever, enzymes, vitamins, minerals, and they found that in order to get the same nutrition that was in the best carrot, you would have to eat something like 20 of the poorest ones to get the same nutrition that it was in the first one. And so there's that much difference, in foods. And so, you know, we certainly see that in ours when we do food fairs. You know, we'll cook a pound of ground beef, for example, and show the difference in the amount of grease that comes off of the store-bought one versus ours. The bacon doesn't shrivel up as much. You actually get more because the hormone ionophores that the industry is using actually makes the muscles artificially swell and take on water. So the animal gains weight faster. You buy more pounds of material, but it's the extra pounds are water. They're not nutrition. And so the density, we had a chef perform a density function on our pork, for example. He got it was one of our hams and got one from Smithfield and did a displacement test in bus pans of water. So he filled them right up to the brim. Mm-hmm. And then he put these two identically weighted hunks of pork in there, and ours displaced way less water. In other words, 10 pounds of our pork was several cubic inches less in volume than the Smithfield pork, meaning that it was more dense. And so when you buy a pound of this, you're not getting fluff, you're actually getting satiation. So, you know, that's one thing. The second thing I would say, when anybody says something about price, I say, okay, great, quickly, let's go to your house. And here's what we're not going to see. We're not going to see lottery tickets, alcohol, cigarettes, takeout. We're not going to see designer jeans. We're not going to see flat screen TVs. We're not, you can go down this line, right? The fact is that many, many people who complain about the price are spending money on something else. The best indicator of this was you're probably familiar with the famous documentary Food Inc. Mm-hmm. And Food Inc. One wonderful documentary. I mean, it was culturally a cataclysm in the culture, but they came off on the same narrative. Remember that family that stopped at Burger King and got that, you know, great big burger and a big soft drink and big fries, and they said, well, we can't afford vegetables. You know, and they just spent that. I'm looking at that, you know, when it came out, I'm looking at that saying, wait a minute, for the money they spent on that fast food meal of junk, they could have bought 2 pounds of our ground beef and cooked it and had, there'd be more nutrition in half a pound of our ground beef than in that entire, you know, $10 meal. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of this is simply rearranging our food dollar, our food buying unprocessed, using your kitchen to prepare, preserve, package, food, and buying in bulk, not buying processed. And look, Dr. Schaffner, the biggest lie that people tell themselves is, I can change my life and I can change the world, but I don't have to change.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's the biggest fraud, right?
Yeah.
The fact is, if you want a different situation for you and you want a different situation for your granddaughter, you have to make some changes. You have to start being intentional about some of the things you do. Now, I'm not a cultist. I'm the 80-20 rule. You know, get 80% right, and you can fudge on the 20% when your niece has a birthday party and they want to serve, you know, ice cream. Enjoy it. Be a you know, don't be a party pooper and enjoy it. Right? Yeah. That's the 20%. But you in order for that 20% to work, you've got to be getting about 80% right, the 80-20 rule. And to me, that's doable. That's something that you don't have to be an ogre in society. You can still, you know, go out with your friends. But most of the time, you're actually, you know, looking through your plate at the landscape that plate is creating. And that makes you start being intentional and making some different decisions.
Yeah, no, I'm totally aligned with you again, Joel. And, you know, and I see this in health, right? So I'm a naturopath, and most of what I do is not supported by insurance. And, you know, we choose to be cash pay, because if we were under that scrutiny, we would never be able to help anyone, right? And so, you know, we're in this like middle of the, you know, paradigm shift, but anyone that we see, like if we don't have our health, you can have all the money in the world, but if you do not have your health, you really don't have your connection to your soul's purpose and your life force, and your days are not joyful. You know, it's, you know, horrific. And that's why we're trying to help as many people who don't have their health. And so I agree. I think that people need to, like, we all these hidden costs of not making these choices that we, you know, see. And so I think that, you know, prioritization, right, and to embrace, and, you know, and this is fun too. I mean, when you like go to a farm like yours and eat the food that you eat, like that you produce, I mean, like, why go back? You know, you will never go back, you know? So no, I think it's people are getting there and understanding that there are so many hidden costs in the cheaper food, you know, and definitely, you know, prevention is, you know, we can't see prevention, right? So it's never glamorous, but I know that we prevent a lot of health conditions choosing, you know, these foods. And so, you know, one thing that my eyes keep opening to, and I'm like, my eyes are getting more aware, and I'm still like baffled by it all, but, you know, this conversation about cows and livestock, and, you know, really cows in particular, are really destroying the planet, are horrific for our health. And, you know, it's a way better option to have like a Beyond Burger with like, you know, fake meat and, you know, dyed blood. And, you know, I mean, it's incredible like that we, you know, present these options, you know. So I guess, what is your take? Are cows really destroying the planet?
great question. And so I'll answer it this way, that if your data points are flawed, then probably your conclusion from the experiment will be flawed. And so the problem is that cowspiracy and what the health and all these you know, plant-based animal livestock hating outfits do is they go to the dysfunctional system to collect their data. They're not coming here. Mm-hmm. They don't come here. And so I like to say it would be equivalent to, let's say you and I lived on Pluto. Mm-hmm. And we look down at the Earth, that planet way down there. And hey, you know, I wonder what they do for education down there. I wonder what their school system's like. And so we jump in our flying saucer and we tool it down to Earth. And we happen to land in the schoolyard that has the worst school superintendent for the region, the worst principal, the worst school. We go visit the worst teacher in the worst classroom, and we spend 2 days. We write our report. We go back, and they say at Pluto, they say, "Well, what'd you find? What would we say? We'd say, my goodness, they'd be better if they didn't even have any education." Right? and that's where we are right now in this cow thing is. You know, when they start off the damage and the terrible and the overgrazing and all, I'm saying, amen, preach it. You know, that's great.
Yeah.
But then when they say, well, the answer is get rid of all the cows, I say, whoa, wait a minute. The tool that can harm can also heal, you know? Mm-hmm. So here, for example, on our farm in 60 years, we've gone, I'll just give you one little point. We've gone from 1% organic matter to over 8% organic matter. Now, organic matter is sequestered. It's not exactly sequestered carbon, but it's a it's a kissing cousin. It's a co-conspirator, a comrade of carbon. Okay, so organic matter. So we've gone from 1% to 8% organic matter. If we took all the agricultural land in the U.S. and moved it only one percentage point in organic matter, just one, not seven like we've done, but one, we would draw down all the atmospheric carbon to pre-1960 levels.
Wow.
That's all it would take. And so, I mean, you know, you can measure the gigatons and all this stuff of that, but this whole carbon issue is missing the soil component that carbon is supposed to be in the soil. And so, you know, yes, have we overgrazed and desertified and planted corn and made deserts and destroyed aquifers? Yes, 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 yes. But realize that 500 years ago, North America produced more nutrition than it does today. Now, it wasn't all eaten by people. You know, there were 200 million beavers that ate more vegetables than all the humans in North America today. There were 2 million wolves that needed 20 pounds of meat a day. So it wasn't all being eaten by people, but the abundance was there. And so to me, that always gives me pause. Anytime somebody heads down this direction, I say, wait a minute. Let's not demonize the animal. Let's instead point the finger at the management of the animal and say, if we can get back to the templates of nature, we can bring back the abundance, we can bring back the atmosphere, we can bring back the ecological balance that was here prior to us messing it up. And so the answer is that these hands, if you will, these hands who have hurt can also heal. And that's where we need to be.
I love it. I think you've taught me, and as we have had throughout this conversation, it's like, you know, the cows and the livestock need to be part of the healing equation. You know, we need to completely transform, you know, how we're doing things, and they can help us recover the soil, right? So it's just only going to, if we take them out of the equation completely, then we're only going to be in more dire straits, you know? And so you're so, you know, in this world, and you're so knowledgeable, and you have all of this experience. I mean, it's kind of probably how I dream of like the new hospital and what that would look like. And, you know, like, you know, it's like, yes. You know, it's yes. Like, you know, it's like, how do you like see, I mean, like, can yep. you, I mean, and there are people like you're, there's a tipping point, but, you know, what do you think, you know, how do you think it's possible to get this, you know, let's just start with North America, because that's we can, you know, put our head, like, how do we start transitioning these, you know, conventional farms and regenerating
them? I would like to start with Swope, yeah. my little village here, you know, can we just start there? You are so right. And yes, we can, you and I, in our specialty, you know, we can build this paradise, right? We can build this fantasy paradise in our head. You can see it. I can see it. It seems so simple, so obvious to us. And yet we have this system that look, if what we did became the new normal, it would completely invert the power, position, prestige, and profits of the entire food and farming system in the world. That's a big ship to turn around. It's a big ship to turn around. So what you, for me, what I've come down to is I'm responsible for what I can touch, what I can influence. I can't, I'll get us ulcers if I get frustrated about the slowness or the recalcitrants, or you know, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, you name it. You know, the sheer, you know, negligence, refusal to see what's obvious. You whatever, it pulls you down. You're stressed. That's no good. And so, so I think one of the most whatever liberating things is to just let that go, and just concentrate on, well, as Stephen Covey said in Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, he said, stay within your sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, he drew these concentric circles. He said, this close one is things that are in your sphere of influence. And then you have this stuff that's beyond your control. And what most people do is spend all their lives railing and demonstrating and carrying on about this that's outside their control, beyond their control. And they fail to actually leverage what's within their control. His point is that if you put your attention on what is within your control, your actual sphere of influence increases. Mm-hmm. If you put all your attention on what's out there beyond your control, your sphere of influence actually shrinks. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm a prime example of that. You know, I don't get all political. I don't, you know, I want to be faithful to the earthworms out here. I want to be faithful to the cows and the tomatoes. And I find that if I can, that is within my influence. And if I put all my attention there, it's a burning bush. It's a burning bush that the world wants to come and see. Mm. And, you know, my dad used to say, you know, to us, every bush is a burning bush, you know, Moses in the burning bush. Mm-hmm. And so, that's kind of where I am. True, you know, man, I want to go back to the Impossible Burger, Beyond Burger, Impossible Meat, just for a moment, and to realize when we talk about food freedom, you know, food security, food freedom, anyone who's into this you know, non-fake meat stuff, I just like to ask them, do you really think it's a more food security system if the material that you're eating can't be grown in your backyard or made in your kitchen, that you are now dependent on, obligated to a laboratory and a bunch of technicians creating a substance that you're going to have to buy? Animals, you know, an egg laid in your backyard, you don't have to ask permission for it. You don't have to know anything. The chicken knows all she needs to know to be a successful egg layer. Okay. You don't have to know anything except, you know, how to keep the chicken happy, and she will give you eggs. One of the most, you know, complete foods that there is. And you can do that right in your, you know, in your own yard, proximate to you. There is tremendous food security and freedom in being able to grow food proximate to where you live, whether it's the backyard or the farmer down the road or whatever. There's tremendous security in us, in democratizing the food production system rather than centralizing it in big fancy laboratories with sophisticated, you know, apparatus, technicians, to run it so that we're all dependent on Soylent Green.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. Like, talk about like the furthest thing from nature as our blueprint. You know, it's right. How could we ever think that is the gold standard? You know, so I so appreciate you saying that. And I want people, you know, we get in this busy life, right? We get busy, we look for convenience, we make choices, you know, but I think there's this movement that you really have been at the root and heart of inspiring, is like, you know, we look at reconnecting, right? Reconnecting with the land, looking at, you know, the natural rhythms and the natural cycles. And I often say, Joel, when I'm, you know, treating what I see in the office, you know, that I feel like our bodies are a microcosm, right, of the macrocosm. And yes, you know, the more that we understand that, right, you know, yes, you know, we see this David and Goliath thing, but we also see this ripple effect, right, that we can have within our families, our communities, our villages. And I think that's the way out. I think that you're right on. And I'll bring kind of a new concept that I'm sure you're well aware of, but I think you probably heard me at our talk about Roland McCready and heart math. And he's really into studying like how the heart affects the body. And then he does all of these studies around how our intention and our heart can affect Mother Earth, and he measures magnetic fields of the earth when people are praying or in intention. And so it brings that kind of, I kind of see this weaving of these ideas of like the more intentional we are with our food, with the land, with Mother Earth, you know,
yes,
the earth responds, right? And we respond, and, you know, and we're not going to be God and know what, how the story ends, but that's good. You know, maybe that's good enough, you know, and that's where the healing happens, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right. The fact is that all of life is pulsating with adaptation and response. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in our bodies, there are how many quadrillion decisions being made in our bodies in every second, you know, within all the microbes and the cells. And this is all, you know, voluntary trading of information and spontaneous responses to, you know, I've got some molybdenum. Do you have some polysaccharide? You know, I mean, it literally is this kind of
exchange. A
biological cafe, if you will. Yeah, you know, yeah. And it's that way in our cells and our bodies and in the larger, you know, the larger world. I mean, plants, we know plants respond to, you know, violin music. I can tell you, being among animals, it makes all the difference in the world if you walk into a flock or a herd and you're upset about something versus that you're calm about something. The animals, you know, everything responds to this, just like your spouse responds to you. They, you know, your spouse knows when you're in a, you know, a funky mood, and your children do. Okay. And I think that we don't just, as Westerners, you know, Greco-Roman Western reductionist, individualized, compartmentalized, disconnected, you know, as we don't appreciate the holism and the connectedness of kind of Eastern thought, at least I don't, you know, I've worked at it. Okay. But come to appreciate that, you know, the tree does respond to, you know, the kind of energy that the tree responds to the wind, you know, and it's not just chemical. It's actually, you know, there's a sentient understanding there within the structure. You know, the acacia trees in the Serengeti, you know, when the giraffes come eating on them, the acacia trees emit a pheromone that goes on the wind, to make the upwind leaves more bitter. You know, people always wondered, why do the giraffes always graze upwind? They all go upwind. Well, why? It's because they're trying to beat the bitter leaves, because the pheromones don't go on the upwind very well. They go downwind. And so this is a defensive mechanism by the tree to make their leaves less palatable to the giraffes. It's a defensive mechanism. Yeah. And so the giraffes are grazing into the wind to try to beat these pheromones that are telling, hey, look out. You're getting ready to get eaten.
Oh, wow. And
I mean, if that isn't sentience and understanding and responding, you know, I don't know what is. And yeah. I think we just sell our womb, our this ecological womb. We sell it short in that level of response.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so beautiful. Like, we're so interconnected, right? And often we just need to step out of the way and observe and follow, you know, follow what's been given, right? And the guidance is there. And I see that with your work. And I try to see that with the work that I do, like facilitating people's health, and just like, how do we get out of the way and get the things out of the way so nature does what, you know, this mm-hmm. intelligent force, you know, that we're all a part of, you know, knows how to move us towards health and healing. And so, so Joel, I could talk to you all day long, and you've inspired me on more ways than you could imagine. And I would love for you to, you know, as we just wrap the interview, like, is there anything else on your heart or your mind that you want to share with the community that's listening?
Thank you. I would say the only thing that I would like to share with everybody is, you know, this whole idea of actual viscerally embracing intentionality can be pretty intimidating. Those are all big words and all that. And I would just encourage everybody that we participate whether we want to or not. I've never seen a frog. I've never walked around the pond and seen a frog look up at me and say, you know what? I'm not going to participate today. I'm going to take the day off. And you know what? We can't take the day off. You know, we are eating, we are thinking, we are doing, and we, as much as you might want to just take the day off and chill out and not do anything, we are willing or unwilling participants. And so my encouragement is to just appreciate when people say, what floats your boat? What floats my boat is I can walk out that back door every day and immerse myself in the privilege and honor and responsibility of being hands and feet that can nurture a benevolent womb umbilical. It's a privilege. It's not a chore. It's not a, oh man, you know, I got it. It's a privilege. And so I would just encourage everybody that whatever, you know, your part, your food dollar, the way you interact, the way you, you know, what you do, what you spend your money on, what you recreate on, how you do things, all of these are part of your and my participation checklist, you know, mm-hmm. that we go through in a day. And so my question is, at the end of the week, looking back, 80-20 rule, 80-20, this is not a cult, okay? Yeah. Looking back, 80-20, have, as a result, have I healed or hurt in the last week? Mm. And that's good enough. Mm-hmm.
So wise, Joel. No, thank you. I'm gonna teach my daughter that. Thank you so much for your wisdom that you're sharing with us today and every day on the summit. And can you just share, you know, any links for people to find out more about you, more about Polyface Farms? Mm-hmm. If they want to order your food, how can they connect with you?
Sure. So we're Polyface, P-O-L-Y-F-A-C-E. It's the farm of many faces. So Polyface Farm, we have a, you know, website. It has everything from, you know, where to order things to my travel speaking engagements, where I'll be if you want to come and hear me yak somewhere. gatherings we're having here at the farm, like you were a part of last year. And we're not having you back, not because we don't love you, but because we're trying to bring new, you know, a rotation of new, fresh faces. You know, we do farm tours. Anyway, the website has it all, and we're glad for you to see what you find there.
Thank you. We'll have that in the notes. And thank you so much being part of the summit and all the incredible work you do. So thank you.
Thank you.